Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have the real pleasure to be talking to the author of Queer Migration Politics, Activist Rhetoric, and Coalitional Possibilities, Karma Chavez. How are you doing today?
I am doing really well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to have you on to talk about this interesting book. Before we get to the meat of the book, maybe you could just tell us a little bit more about yourself. You've got your hands in lots of different things. Tell us about it.
Sure. Work-wise, I am currently, I just earned tenure, so I will soon be an associate professor of communication arts in Chicano.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Always good news.
Right.
So of, like I said, Comm Arts and Chicano and Latino Studies at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And I've been there for, this is my fourth year. I do a lot of community work as well. I work on the board of the Wisconsin Network for Peace and Justice and do a lot of work on immigrant rights there. And I work with a radical queer collective called Against Equality, which provides queer critiques of the mainstream LGBT movement. So, and I do some radio on community radio, WORT in Madison as well. So try to be a good, public intellectual or something. But
yeah, and it really does show up in the book, which is both deeply theoretical, but obviously has these firsthand experiences sometimes showing up prominently, but also always in the background. It makes it a very interesting read. So let's get talking about the book itself.
Sure.
And because he's a personal favorite of mine, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what Congressman Jerry Nadler did on Valentine's Day in the year 2000, and what was its significance?
Sure. So one of the things that had been going on through the early 90s was some organizing, specifically in cities, to try to get the LGBT and the immigrant rights movement together around the issue of binational same-sex couples. And so, of course, until very, very recently, within this year, if you were, say, legally married in another country, and you're one of you was a U.S. citizen, another was, say, a resident of Denmark, or some country that provided marriage, you could not legally sponsor your same-sex partner for immigration benefit. And so this seemed like a likely alliance for LGBT and immigrant rights advocates, and so what culminated on Valentine's Day in 2000 was Representative Nadler, of course, proposing what was then called the PPIA, the Permanent Partners Immigration Act, which was designed to provide this benefit to same-sex partners, regardless whether they were married or not. And, of course, it failed every year. It continued to fail legislatively, but that was recently changed with the end of DOMA in June of 2012.
Right, and if I read that portion of the book right, Nadler's approach would be one of inclusion. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where the common cause has been found between immigration advocates and LGBT advocates. What issues do they care about in common?
Yeah, so you're right. So Nadler's approach is sort of what in the book I talk about as a more inclusionary approach, which has been characterized at that intersection around the issues of LGBT asylum, so people getting asylum, political asylum in the U.S. based on their sexual orientation or gender identity, the HIV ban on in immigration, which only ended in 2010, so people who were HIV positive, with rare exception, could not legally come to the United States until 2010. And then, of course, this issue of binational same-sex couples, which became the main issue above all other issues until DOMA. I think I said 2012 earlier, but 2013, the end of DOMA. So those were the three main convergences with that one approach. And then I say that there was a lot of other work going on that didn't focus on trying to get included in existing structures, which organized around prisons, around AIDS, but not so much necessarily legal, but actually community building, and then around immigration justice in a broader sense that wasn't just about couples.
Yeah, you talk a lot in the book about manifestos and the way in which various interests and activists frame their arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this one document, Family Unvalued, where it came from, who wrote it, what did it argue, and sort of where it sits in the various intersecting movements that are the subject of your book.
Yeah, that's a great question. So Family Unvalued was a 2006 report that was put out by the Human Rights Watch and the group Immigration Equality. And it's interesting, the authors of this, Scott Long, Jessica Stern, and Adam Francoeur. Scott Long worked for Human Rights Watch at the time. He no longer does, but he's actually he's a very, very radical international queer human rights activist, which is probably why he no longer works for Human Rights Watch. But so these three folks, this first report, it was about a 200-page report written in 2006, and it focused primarily on the issue of binational same-sex couples and the struggles that these folks faced during all the time leading up to 2013. And so it's really a heartfelt approach to their stories. They're very sad stories. I mean, it's not easy to live across two countries. So Family Unvalued came out in 2006, which of course is the same year that all the big immigrant rights and justice marches happened. So whether that was planned or sort of coincidental, it's hard to say. But in the book I write about that this was sort of this one very well-funded large report, but there were also a number of other smaller manifestos that took a very different perspective that didn't center the needs of binational same-sex couples, but took a more broad justice kind of approach that also came out in 2006-2007. So it was a very exciting times for this intersection, I think, of queer and immigration politics in the U.S.
Yeah, I study nonprofits, and so I was so intrigued by your description of this phrase, the gay nonprofit industrial complex. So what is this? How does it function? And how does it relate to the intersections that you've been talking about thus far?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complex thing, and it's I'll leave it there. It's a complex thing. So in 2007, Insight Women of Color Against Violence put out a book called The Revolution Will Not Be Funded. And in that book, they named what they called the nonprofit industrial complex. And in short, the pieces in that collection critique the way that all social justice organizing has been channeled into this nonprofit structure. So, maybe in the early 70s or in the 60s, people would do activism after their day job, but now activism is people's day job. And so a lot of people have critiqued this as really narrowing the agenda. It gives a lot of power to, of course, philanthropists and grant funders who kind of dictate where the agenda can go. Well, in terms of LGBT rights, there's been a lot of critique of this, focusing all efforts on marriage in particular, and sort of secondarily military and hate crime legislation. But we've actually seen this in the way that funding happens now. If you're a gay organization and you don't have something to deal with equality, it's very, very hard to get funding. Yeah, I was talking with, just as an anecdote, I was talking with one of the archivists at the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco, and she said they have a hard time getting money because everyone has oriented their funding toward marriage and equality. So this is kind of what the activists I write about critique, is to say, well, what happens to a more radical agenda that might actually meet the needs of people who maybe wouldn't benefit from something like marriage?
Yeah, and I think I found that section of the book in this argument you make about other approaches just so interesting. You use the term differential visions as a way to structure some of the way you conceptualize this. And explaining that term, I wonder if you also then might explain really the title of your book, Queer Migration Politics. What does that phrase mean? And what does it do to help us understand these complex politics?
Sure. So the concept of the differential begins with the Chicana feminist Chela Sandoval, who proposed the concept of differential consciousness to describe how women of color feminists in the U.S. have always had to practice a kind of impure politics. And so much like the differential of a car, they sort of shift in and out of different political modes in order to accomplish what they need to accomplish. Amy Carrillo-Ro, who's another Chicana feminist, she takes up this term, the differential, and she applies it to the notion of belonging. And she says that differential belonging is sort of a political mode of relating where we sort of shift in and out of different relationalities, not just modes of consciousness, in order to build power lines between people who are very different. So what I try to do with the differential vision is I try to bring back the kind of consciousness or sort of orientation of Sandoval with the focus on belonging in Carrillo-Ro to show the way that activists put these two modes together to kind of shift in and out to create of political modes, to create these visions of how they imagine their politics. And so I'm trying to use that term to describe the impurity of their approach.
Yeah, and when I was reading the book, which is deeply scholarly and deeply embedded in the literature, I was very curious what the response is to, if not just the book recently came out, but to your writing by activists across the spectrum, across the different parts of this movement. Have you had experiences where activists are able to give you feedback on these scholarly approaches? Do they resonate with people who are advocating for all of the different issues that you describe? Has that been a part of sort of the rollout of the book?
Yeah, I mean, for the whole process, I definitely have been in conversation with different activists. In fact, many of the people in the book, which, you know, sort of outside of scholarly convention, but have become friends through the research and the writing. Perhaps most notably, the folks in the last chapter, Kat and Kathy, who are the two key players, neither of whom work for those organizations any longer, which is always interesting mm-hmm. when a book comes out. But so both Kat and Kathy had a chance to read my dissertation, which is what Chapter 4 was based on, and provide feedback on that. Kat and I are still in very regular communication. Yasmin Nair and I, we write together outside of the academy, and she's also a collaborator and friend. I know Jose Herrera, I know Raul Ochoa, so many of the activists I know and have read the work. And I haven't sent all of them the book yet, so none of them have commented on the final draft, but there was mm-hmm. a lot of back and forth as we went. And, you know, some of it resonates and some of it is they just, I think some folks, Kat in particular, will make fun of, you know, the theoretical parts of it. But
right.
But there is some resonance, I think.
Right, right. So what do you make of this overall? What are we to take away from some of your findings? In sort of the light of the DOMA decisions, the more recent DOMA decisions, where do these issues stand right now? Where are activists placing their energy now? Is this idea of differential visions becoming a greater part of the conversation as marriage equality becomes more of a legal reality in a larger portion of the country? What's happened to the gay nonprofit industrial complex as a result? So where are we now?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, so I'll step back just a moment from that to say, you know, part of the big project of the book is to say we've been given very little options when it comes to LGBT politics. So on the one hand, we've been given a strong inclusionary agenda based primarily on marriage equality. And then on the other hand, we've been given from queer theorists a focus on the realm of the aesthetic and on utopias and ideas that are very, very exciting, but that are often less connected to the material world of politics. And so what I was really trying to do is find a way to offer an alternative to these alternatives and to think about coalition as maybe being that alternative. And I think what the intersection of queer migration does is it shows that a lot of the tropes that get relied upon in LGBT politics, like citizenship, for example, you have to rethink that strategy when you're in connection with immigration, because that's not something immigrants can rely upon. And so that was part of the project of the book. Of course, you know, me as a self-identified more radical activist, you know, we are in a place now where, okay, we kind of have lost in a certain way as marriage equality becomes a reality. But on the other hand, I think there is a movement to want more than what the inclusionary agenda provides, but not to completely isolate that agenda. And that's really what I was hoping to show, is that there is an alternative that doesn't require just completely dismissing a mainstream agenda if you're a radical activist, but also doesn't require you to sort of turn to the complete realm of the imaginary. But I will say, in very material ways, I mean, the organization Queers for Economic Justice has just closed its doors. And many radical organizations are one step away from that. So, you know, what I have provided a glimpse of in the book may very well be that, a glimpse. But I do think those glimpses do exist in small places throughout the country.
Yeah, yeah. I enjoyed the book a lot.
Thank you.
One that could be read in lots of different both disciplines, but also sub-disciplines across a number of different fields. What's next for you? Without putting any pressure on your schedule, is there a new book in the near future? What are you working on next?
Sure. You know, I am very interested in this intersection of queer politics and immigration politics. And so the next project that I'm working on right now is I want to write about AIDS activism on the issue of immigration. So most writing about AIDS activism in the U.S. has completely centered on queer politics, specifically gay men and their lesbian allies. And yet AIDS policies in the U.S. have always targeted immigrant communities. And immigrants have always been among the most greatly affected. So what I'm planning to look at, or what I'm looking at right now, is the ways that immigrant communities either coalesced with queer activists, or sometimes worked separate from, but as AIDS activists, around issues that were important to immigrant communities in the U.S.
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting, broad research agenda, and the current book, Queer Migration Politics, Activist Rhetoric and Coalitional Possibilities, published by Illinois University Press and available at their website. Karma, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Heath. I appreciate it.